The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anushka Astana. As we hurtle towards 2018, likely to be Britain's last full year as a member of the European Union, well, technically at least, we'll look ahead to the dawning reality of tough trade talks as the political calendar fills up with never-ending Brexit meetings. The EU's chief negotiator says any transition period will expire at the end of 2020. So, as Jeremy Corbyn says he expects to be Prime Minister next year, is it time for Labour to decide what kind of Brexit it wants? Also this week, after a year of presidential tweeting, we examine digital diplomacy with one of the earliest adopters.
The internet is going to open up societies and it's going to give people a much clearer idea of what's going on elsewhere, and that the autocracies and the Putins of this world will be in retreat, ultimately.
And an epidemic of loneliness is causing untold damage to the lives of millions of people in Britain. We speak to the MPs who took over from the late Joe Cox to find practical solutions to a hidden crisis.
The great thing about this problem is that it is entirely solvable.
But first, I'm joined in the studio by the political commentator Ellie May O'Hagan, the Observer's policy editor Michael Savage, and a trade geek, Sam Lowe, who is about to start a job at the Centre for European Reform. Now, if 2017 had its moments of horror for Theresa May, it's been transformative for Jeremy Corbyn. Gone are the challenges to his leadership. Now he appears on the front cover of Style magazines, has his name chanted at musical festivals, and this week has given an interview in which he says he expects to be Prime Minister next year. But is he ready to take control of the biggest issue facing Britain, Brexit? Ellie, you were an early champion of Corbyn in the media. How has this year changed him? And do you think he has done enough to convince voters to put him in Downing Street if there were a snap election in 2018?
I think this year you saw the Corbyn leadership team kind of taking it up a notch. I think there were some few internal changes in terms of personnel. And I think the snap election really offered the whole Corbyn project, by which I don't just mean the leadership, but all of the supporters that he's gained, you know, a chance to really actually put their money where their mouth is. And I think the definitive change that happened was the manifesto. You know, I witnessed lots and lots of sceptical people come around to Corbyn as a leader once that was published. In terms of whether he's done enough, I think, you know, the likelihood is that there would be a Labour government. I don't think that he would win a big majority at this stage. I think politics is extremely volatile. I would warn Labour against complacency. And I think that really what Corbyn needs to do in the coming year is to expand the electorate, more young people, more non-voters, because I think that winning over the over 65s is going to be quite a tough ask.
And are there particular things Labour are doing to try to achieve that?
Yeah, well, they're looking more at community organising, obviously, like their policy offer. They are engaging more with social media, that kind of thing. And I think that they need to just step that up more and keep doing it, because I think
that's
the way that
they'll
win.
Social media, presumably, not the best way to get to the over 65s.
No, I'm saying that's what I'm saying, is that I think that that's going to be a very tough ask for them. So they should try and expand the electorate in terms of young people and non-voters.
OK, that's interesting. And Michael, would your money be on an election in 2018?
Well, history would tell you if there's a prime minister in trouble, they might try and hold on. So if you think about the troubles that John Major had, you know, he did, you know, get to 5 years. And in some ways, now that Theresa May has got to the second part of the Brexit negotiations, she's arguably in as strong a position as she's been since the election. So I find it hard to see there being one. That said, I've been wrong about a lot of things in the last 18 months, and that could well just be another one to add to the list.
Well, you're not alone in that. And just on Labour, some would say that they've managed successfully to appeal to both Leave and Remain voters, and that's how they got that 40% in the election. Some critics might say by fudging the issue of Brexit somewhat. Is that dangerous moving forward? And how important do you think the anti-Brexit vote was in the 2017 election?
Well, it was clearly a very complicated result, given that it was a surprise. And there's been a lot of debate about what role did the Brexit vote play in that. I think for Labour, you know, they got a lot of criticism before the election because they were unclear on Brexit, trying to ride two horses, appeal to those supporters who wanted to leave, appeal to those others who voted for them who wanted to stay in. but arguably it worked very well. So, you know, you could make an argument that, you know, what's worked well for Labour so far could work well in the future. They could continue to fudge and might well keep trying to push the fudge. It will frustrate a lot of people. Will it ultimately be unsuccessful? Of course, the obvious question is, what price leadership? If they really think we should stay in the single market, for instance, shouldn't they be clear about it? And I think that is a debate that's got a long way to run.
Well, Sam, I introduced you as a trade geek, so let's delve into that a little bit. Today in the House of Commons, Labour MP Chris Leslie has laid an amendment to say we should stay permanently inside the customs union. Now, the Labour Party is saying not to support that at the moment. What do you think their position is on the customs union? And do you think ultimately they will be arguing to remain?
I think it's a difficult one because I'm entirely unclear what their position is on many things to do with Brexit. And I take the previous point, I think that's maybe deliberate and there might be something in that. But when we talk about the customs union, I think it becomes quite tricky because there's this idea that you can stay in the European customs union once you have left the European Union is actually contested. It's something that's only available to European Union members with caveats. Essentially, if you look at the Crown dependencies, you can find caveats all over the place. So they might be saying you shouldn't vote for this, but then it wouldn't surprise me if later on in the debate they came forward and say, but we should be in a customs union. It's the difference between the and a, because Turkey is in a customs union with the European Union, for example. So I think it's something that's clearly still on the table and still yet to be discussed. But it seems that they're not so keen on sort of nailing their flag to the mast on it currently.
And are there things that would be damaging for an economy if we stayed in a customs union?
All of the economic work on this suggests that the least damaging option is as close as we can remain to the European Union as possible. So the least amount of damage would be remaining in the European Union. And beyond that, the more we diverge, the more damaging it is. So remaining in a customs union would be better for the economy than leaving it. But it does, of course, put constraints on what a future government can do in relation to its future trading relations with the rest of the world. So it's essentially becomes a political question in a sort of land where I think the pursuit of future trade agreements has become a sort of benchmark for the success of Brexit, even if it might have just leave us worse off than we were before.
OK, and we will come back to that. But Ellie, one thing I want to ask you is there has been different arguments made on the Labour side. Some people clearly desperate to remain as close as possible, perhaps to a Norway-style model, or even some who want to reverse Brexit completely. From the leadership, there have been some concerns about the idea that if we were to remain in the single market, for example, that might limit Labour's opportunities to take steps on state aid, for example, in industries. How important do you think that argument is? And do you think it has sway with that great army of Corbynites who came to support the party this year?
I think in terms of people in the Labour Party having different stances, I think that someone like Chris Leslie can be sort of safely ignored. I think he's just making mischief, as he has been doing for the last couple of years, and I think should probably just ignore him. In terms of the Labour leadership stance on staying in the single market and so on, I've spoken to people in the Corbyn team, and my understanding of the line is that they take on Brexit is that no options are off the table, and they want to pursue what they call a jobs first Brexit, which means that the priority will be safeguarding jobs. And I think that given the position that they're in terms of lots of their voters in their seats voting Brexit, I think really they have very little choice but other than to take a position like that. And, you know, I'm a journalist who spent 2 years now interviewing probably hundreds and hundreds of Corbyn supporters. And I think that the idea that Corbyn has inspired people because they want to remain in the EU is just not true. I think that most of Corbyn's supporters have an entirely different vision of the way that they want British society to be organised, which extends beyond Brexit. And that's why they've decided to back the current Labour Party.
But you talk about Chris Leslie causing trouble. There's clearly a lot of Labour MPs who feel very passionately about the idea of remaining in the single market or customs union, for example. And among the Labour membership, support for those positions is overwhelming. Over 85% of Labour members like that position. Do you think there comes a point at which Jeremy Corbyn and his wider team are actually going to go further in order to satisfy those members?
I don't know, but I spoke to a lot of Labour voters who voted Remain and were very strongly in favour of Remain in the run-up to the election. And they all continued to vote Labour because they recognised that if they didn't, the likelihood is we would get a Tory majority and then an even harder Brexit. I do think that there is an understanding amongst Labour support that the leadership has to take the position that it's taken. I think that the amount of people who want to reverse Brexit is actually tiny, even amongst the Remain voters. So I think there is, at the moment, in terms of Labour's voting base and in terms of its supporters, a kind of truce where they understand that Labour needs to take a kind of amicable position. That might change. I would say that I don't think that any Labour voter thinks that Labour would do a worse job than the Tories are at the moment. So that is also something to bear in mind.
And do you agree with that, Michael, that there's been a truce from Labour supporters? They understand why Labour is taking the central position, if you want to call it that, or not?
Yeah, well, I think if you look at what Labour sort of need to do tactically, again, you could argue that if you take the position that pragmatically people think, you know, we voted to leave the EU, so it has to be done, but let's do it in the best possible way, then Labour in that circumstance would have to be slightly less Brexity than the Conservatives and reap the benefits of being seen as a softer Brexit party.
And I suspect Ellie might put Tony Blair in the same category as Chris Leslie. But I noticed in an interview in The Guardian the other day, he basically said Labour's position is essentially the same as the Tory position.
Yeah, so this is one of the really tricky things that's going on, which is there's a lot of people out there who think leaving the EU is such a bad idea that you have to reverse it. But also the reason people voted for Brexit was because of a whole load of other social ills that have gone unresolved. But Tony Blair is taking this very difficult approach of saying, OK, well, let's try and listen to these people finally by reversing these social ills, but ignore the one thing that they've just told us they wanted, which is Brexit. This is one of these really complicated things that's happened where the Brexit vote seemed to indicate one thing about what's happening to the country, but can you really undo a democratic vote?
And I'm just going to come to you, Sam, but on that point, interestingly, Blair, bizarrely in that interview, Ellie, was essentially saying that Jeremy Corbyn was going against the principles of the party in order to get power, whilst Tony Blair said, actually, it's not about power. We've got to just stick to our principles on this. Did you see a certain irony in that?
Well, it's completely illogical. And obviously, it is ironic in terms of what the things that Blair has said in the past. And I think to understand where he's coming from, we need to look at the bigger picture here. We know that the type of politics that Tony Blair represents is collapsing all over Europe and across the world. And we know that Brexit represented a huge break with the status quo, a huge rejection of those kind of politics. And I think that people like Tony Blair and like Chris Leslie would like to reverse Brexit. Yes, Brexit will be extremely damaging. I don't disagree with that at all. But I think that there is another motivation for them, which is that they kind of hope that if they can just stop this one thing, that maybe all of those changes will go back in the box and will go back to the way things were. And that isn't going to happen.
Well, Labour justifies its position, Sam, by saying, hang on, we're not the ones doing the negotiating. So can I turn to the people who are doing the negotiating, Theresa May and her government? The EU talking today about ending a transition period by the end of 2020. The Prime Minister says a trade deal will actually be done long before that, by March 2019. I think Michel Barnier perhaps thinks the end of the transition period. Are either of those timescales realistic?
I think we're going to be stuck around this table talking about Brexit for many more years. Many
so
more
we'll be
years
having trade geeks with us for many years.
Well, I hope so, because my sort of employment depends on it. But no, I don't hope so. Obviously, I want to see this resolved as quickly as possible in a given direction. But I think we have an issue. I mean, I think Michel Barnier is more right than Theresa May. I think one of the things that people have got confused about with the second phase of negotiations is that everyone seems to have convinced themselves that we're now about to do some trade talks. Actually, we're about to do the talks about the trade talks. And you know this because you can read Article 50, it's written down.
Why do we need to talk about talks about trade talks? Is that the right amount of talks?
Well, first we need essentially to create a mandate. So what are we going to be talking about? What are the parameters? And to do that, we need to give a signal to the Commission, essentially, of which direction we want to go. And they frame it as Canada or Norway. That's an example. I mean, it's not going to literally be Canada or Norway because, the Canada-EU agreement mentions Canada. So it can't literally be that agreement.
So it'll be bespoke. It will say United Kingdom.
Exactly. But it gives an idea to the direction of travel. And that's what we're talking about here. Do we want to extricate ourselves from the European Union's regulatory regime and the obligations that come with it or not? If we are okay with remaining in that, then we have a certain set of options within a given framework which looks something like what Norway has. If we want to extract ourselves from it, then you have something like what Canada looks like. And that's as far as you're going to get. We're not going to be negotiating tariff lines on pork or something in this phase. That will be after Article 50 is over and during this transition period, which is looking, as per the EU proposals today, as if it will be essentially everything as it is now, minus political representation, and something that interested me in there, minus all of the trade deals we currently have via the EU.
Oh, so the grandfathering you don't think will be able to be done in time for 2019? No. And by grandfathering, I mean replicating those trade deals that already exist with the EU.
No, so that's, well, I don't think that would be able to be done in time, but that's still an option we have. But what they said in their guidelines today is that those, even if we go into this standstill interim transition period, all of our treaties with the rest of the world that have been negotiated by the EU will disappear on March 2019. So that's a hard deadline, even if we go into this transition period, which means Liam Fox's department has a lot of work to do up until then, because you lose agreements with countries such as Turkey, which we're in a customs union with at the moment, to the EEA countries, so Norway, Iceland, Liechtenstein, Switzerland. These all go off a cliff in March 2019. Even if we go into this transition where everything else remains the same.
Okay, and after we've talked about trade talks, Michael, we're going to have to talk about this implementation period or transition period, depending who you are talking about it. Now, everyone seems to think that's pretty easy, it'll be wrapped up by March, but potentially there are some real serious sticking points.
Well, there are, and the problem with this one, as someone once said, is the clock is ticking. So every day there isn't a transition agreement, businesses draw up more contingency plans and start to enact them. So even if we got one, if it came late, it might be pointless in some cases. That's the danger we have. And I think, you know, generally looking forward to 2018, if you thought 2017 had a lot of Brexit in it, you're in for a shock, because like all sequels, it's going to be noisier, louder, with more explosions, I suspect.
Hurrah, up with trade geeks to talk a lot about that. How hopeful would you be about the timeline? I mean, one senior Tory in Brussels told me, essentially, what you might look at getting by 2019 is a 50-page document, you know, essentially a joint report, a bit like we had on the withdrawal agreement, which outlines the type of trading arrangement we will have. And then you'd be looking at around a 1,500-word document beyond that. I mean, how realistic is it that either of those could get done?
Well, I quite often go back to what our former EU ambassador, Sir Ivan Rogers, said, because he's been right about a lot of things. He left his job under Theresa May. He's been right about pretty much everything so far. The one thing left that he said would happen that hasn't yet happened is this whole process would take far longer. Brexit would essentially be complete by the mid-2020s. And it feels to me like all the timelines being talked about at the moment are very optimistic.
Do you agree with that, Sam?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think it's going to drag out for a long time. So to give an example, so the EU-Canada agreement, which is quite shallow, it largely just deals with goods, not very much on services and a bit on qualifications. That took 7 years. And of course, I understand...
But of course, David Davis would argue we start from the same position.
Yeah, so we start from the same position, but first we have to decide actually how far do we want to go. And that's essentially a discussion that's going to take a long time within the UK, and we're not there yet. You hear the cabinet still arguing with each other about that.
Although there does seem to be a consensus in this week's cabinet discussion around the starting point for the government. So yes, there are who thought we'd be talking about it, divergers and aligners in the cabinet, you know, from Gavin Williamson, interestingly, perhaps, to Amber Rudd. But they seem to be behind the idea of an opening gambit for a kind of what they call Canada plus, which is a Canada-style agreement with more services. I mean, there are templates with a bit more, like Korea, for example. Is there anything other than the political desire to block that? Is there any technical, yes, economic reason why you wouldn't have that?
Well, so the issue you haven't, and Korea and Canada are pretty much the same on services. Yeah. One of the issues that the EU has on its side is written into its agreements of the like of Canada and Korea is a clause which says that if in future the EU negotiates an agreement similar to that, that grants another country, for example, the UK, more access for its services, it then has to unilaterally grant that to Korea and Canada as well. And that's an issue in that I've talked to people from the DG Trade, so the EU, the Commission's trade department, who have brought this up, and they said this is a big problem. And you can get out of being bound by that. There are caveats, because otherwise the EEA agreement couldn't exist, the Norway model couldn't exist, but that requires essentially regulatory harmonisation and being within the structures, the oversight, with the oversight and the obligations of the EU.
Okay.
I was just going to say, this is a symptom of life out on your own, really, that actually the EU, as I understand it, has already come under pressure from other countries saying, if you do a good deal for Britain, then you've got to be careful what you're offering us. You know, this is life.
But there are European countries that are very dependent on trade with the UK that might be arguing internally that we can't afford to fall off a cliff as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's largely around goods, where we get a lot of EU goods. But of course, the big one for us is services, where we sell a lot of services. So you can do a deal on goods, which pleases everyone in Europe. Can you do something on services, which is what we're after?
And before, I want to talk quickly about a couple of domestic issues. I have to ask you, Michael, if it ends up being the case, as Sam has suggested, that we do end up having to choose essentially between something like a Canada-style agreement or something like a Norway-style agreement where we're inside the single market, do you think that Theresa May would make use of the majority in Parliament for that Norway-style option?
Well, I think actually, it's an interesting question. Is there a majority in the Commons for single market membership? There was a time where I'd say absolutely yes. But the election did something quite interesting on this point, in that the Tory manifesto explicitly says we're leaving the single market and the customs union. And even people like Nicky Morgan, who have been very, very fierce in wanting to stay in at one point, say, well, that might well make a difference to how I vote. So you've got people like her saying, I'm not sure. It's not obvious there is a majority now.
One thing I would add, just going back to the Chris Leslie point earlier about, is he just troublemaking by talking about this? Now, I think maybe within the context of Labour, you could argue that. But in the terms of the broader debate, it's absolutely essential we are actually having these discussions now, because I still don't think the majority of MPs, the public, knows the difference between a customs union and the single market. And that's completely fine. There was no reason to have known this before now. But actually, we're hitting a point where these are big decisions coming up with big implications for our economic standing in the world and also social and environmental protections going forward. So we do need to start having these conversations now and start to work out what exactly we want.
The conversations we all thought we might have had during the EU referendum campaign itself. Ellie, the big reason why Theresa May says we have to leave the single market isn't because she doesn't want to be close economically. It's because immigration was one of the great big reasons that people voted for Brexit. Not the only one, but one of them. How does the Labour Party handle that, given that Jeremy has been quite clear he doesn't want a situation where he's essentially pandering to the right?
The Labour Party position on that is fair migration, I think. I think they are looking...
What is that?
I don't know. I wouldn't want to give them a position that they haven't taken on that. So I'm not going to speculate further on that one. That is a very tricky position for Labour to be in, and I only hope that they do back freedom of movement eventually, just because, for the simple reason that migration will only increase as the years go on, particularly because of the climate crisis. And what worries me is that if migration becomes any more of a toxic issue, as it was incredibly so, thanks to the various Leave campaigns, then I worry about what kind of immigration policies we could see, what implications that have. We know that the far right is on the rise across Europe and in the US. And I hope that Labour backs freedom of movement and is pro-migration with a view to preventing this kind of xenophobic sentiment that is on the rise in a lot of Western countries.
But Michael, wouldn't that be quite dangerous in a lot of the northern constituencies that voted to leave? They would argue, perhaps not because of xenophobia, but because they were worried about the impact of immigration on their lives.
So freedom of movement, you're totally right, is the thing that has driven this thing to where we've got to now, which is a relatively hard Brexit position, because that is Theresa May's position. For Labour, you're dead right. They've got this issue in some of their constituencies that were very pro-Brexit, and immigration was an issue. And what we've ended up with is a totally glorious fudge. Free movement. I heard easy movement the other day. I don't know what that means either. These are
to
questions.
To be fair to Keir Starmer, I think it was put to him by Andrew Marr rather than a phrase he came up with himself.
Yeah, like the rest of us trying to figure out what on earth the position is. As you said before, this is something they're going to have to come down on one side or the other.
OK, and I just want to ask a couple of questions about domestic policy. It's been quite interesting, Ellie. You know, the Labour Party have been pushing very hard on particular issues. So, for example, homelessness, universal credit, they've been using a lot of statistics around that. And what we're seeing from the government is perhaps a bit more of a fight back than there has been before. Theresa May in the House of Commons trying to hit back at suggestions about homelessness. I was speaking to David Gawke, the Welfare Secretary, today, who says that essentially Tory ministers have to enter the battlefield on social media. And he was doing that against the Labour MP, Frank Field. How do you see this kind of unfolding in terms of the kind of value divide in Britain? And do you think it could be effective for the Tories to respond in this way?
I mean, the Conservatives are faced with, I wrote about this recently for The Guardian, actually, that the Conservatives are faced with a kind of intractable problem in the sense that their voter base, their donor class and lots of people within their party are very opposed to the values and policies that increasingly young people seem to hold. And Conservative voters are dying because they're old and people turn 18 every day. And so what you've got is this issue where Conservative voters are stopping voting because they're dying. And there are new Labour voters coming about every day and they know this. And that's why they're trying to push back against this nasty party mantle. Like, let's remember it was Theresa May in the first place who said that they needed to get rid of that impression. Because they're aware that they need to, in some ways, protect their voter base and so on, which involves socially conservative policies. It involves kind of protecting home ownership and that kind of thing. But they also know that those policies are increasingly unpopular with young people. And that is a problem for them. And I think that's what they're trying to sort of negotiate at the moment. I don't really see a way around it until the things like the housing crisis is resolved and wages stop stagnating, because ultimately people are not going to be Conservatives if they have nothing to conserve. They're not going to be capitalists if they don't have any capital. And that is the problem facing the Conservatives at the moment.
Well, someone I spoke to in the party today said in order to present their new caring self in the new year, they're going to be talking about housing, school standards and, of course, animal welfare. Thank you all for joining me. Well, you can follow all our reporting on Brexit in The Guardian and Observer at theguardian.com/politics. Now, one of the most alarming developments in a tumultuous political year has been nuclear powers taunting each other on Twitter. On the 12th of November, for example, President Trump tapped out this tweet. Why would Kim Jong-un insult me by calling me old when I would never call him short and fat? Oh well, I try so hard to be his friend, and maybe someday that will happen. I'm joined on the line now by Tom Fletcher, a former British ambassador and author of The Naked Diplomat, subtitle Understanding Power and Politics in the Digital Age. So Tom, diplomacy used to be a careful, nuanced business left to highly experienced diplomats. Has Trump ripped up the rule book?
Well, I think, to be honest, the internet had already ripped up that rule book. And so that world of sort of Ferrero Rocher diplomacy carried out between elites using these sort of platitudes of diplomacy about warm bilateral relations and so on, I think that was already being disrupted by technology. And it was probably a good thing. It was already opening up, becoming more accessible to people. I think Trump, in a way, then blew another hole in all of that. Without doubt, his social media has changed the way that we communicate with each other. But more than that, his diplomacy more widely has changed the rules. I mean, he's created a vacancy for leader of the free world. And so it feels much more like international relations is a bit of a free-for-all now. I mean, I think it's very important that we separate, you know, Trump, the pantomime villain, from where he actually really damages our collective interests. And I'd argue that, you know, obviously his policies on climate change, his cuts to diplomacy and development, his approach to Islam and the Middle East, his attacks on the international system, these are all real fundamental challenges to the way that we see the world and organize the world. And yeah, that is very dangerous. And we're seeing, you know, much more of an effort now to stand up to that worldview.
Okay, but even the pantomime villain can cause real problems. I mean, a few weeks ago, he actually retweeted a far-right British account. He then fired off tweets rebuking the Prime Minister for appearing to criticise him. I mean, this week, Twitter have actually banned the Britain First account from being used. I mean, how do you deal with that as a diplomat, as an ambassador?
Well, it is great to see Twitter take action against those extremist accounts. And, you know, it is a pretty sad day when you see any leader retweeting that kind of hatred, let alone the leader of a country that, you know, we still want to believe is the shining city on a hill. I think you have to try and look at it very rationally. You have to look at it issue by issue. You can't descend to his level. You know, just as we always say, don't feed the trolls. You know, that applies whether or not the troll is, you know, a Russian bot tweeting at you from some warehouse in Siberia, or whether the troll is sitting in the White House. It's best not to descend to that level and try and keep it about substance.
Okay, but one of the reactions that resulted in was pretty extraordinary scenes in the Houses of Parliament here in the UK, MP after MP standing up to say how disgusted they were with Donald Trump, and critically, that they wouldn't welcome him to this country. I mean, we've got a situation where Sadiq Khan is saying, the Mayor of London is saying he shouldn't have a state visit. Now, the government is pushing ahead with that. Is that the right thing to do? And if so, how should Britain handle that visit?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what a state visit really involves. I think you do have to have a dialogue with the President of the United States of America. And however bad we regard the things he's done as, he's still in that position, and we still need to have that engagement, that relationship on a number of absolutely key issues. Now, whether or not that means we have to roll out the gold carriage for him is another issue. I think a lot of people felt that invitation was a bit hasty. Most American presidents since the Second World War have only been offered state visits in their second term. So we tend to stick around and wait for a bit to see whether or not they're going to be doing the kind of job that we would hope they'd be doing before offering a state visit. I get the sense that the Trump's position on climate change, this recent understandable anger over his retweeting of the extremist tweets, I think they will all have pushed that state visit planning towards the back burner, if not right down the back of the oven altogether.
And meanwhile, we have a situation which has been heightened in Palestine and Israel, perhaps because of the intervention of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think in my experience in the Middle East, the Americans have always been at their best when they've tried to put out fires and not to start new ones. And I'm not convinced that the current White House approach is actually about putting out fires, sadly. But it's quite striking. You know, in those years in Downing Street, I mentioned every time that we got close to not voting alongside America at the UN Security Council, or even being one, we used to call it one beep away when they were voting for a resolution and we were voting against it rather than abstaining, we would get huge anger from throughout our system and in fact, from Washington. So it's quite striking then to see our perm rep quite rightly voting yesterday for this vote in the UN Security Council resolution, which criticized the American approach. It shows that, that people are willing to stand up to this this approach that Trump is taking to the world.
Okay, and although the Middle East perhaps puts it in context, I guess a big issue for us at the moment is Brexit, a real crunch point for British diplomacy. How do you think we're being seen from abroad? Are there any reasons to be upbeat?
Well, I think that the fundamental challenge here actually goes beyond Brexit itself, and it's all about how we're seen in the world. At the moment, we're seen as this creative industry's superpower. You know, people love our arts, our sport, our design, our technology. But we also have this reputation as being competent and pretty good at running things. You know, if you like, it's a kind of triple A star rating for competence. And whatever your view on Brexit, the rights or wrongs of it, it's so important that our handling of Brexit doesn't lose us that reputation for competence and basically knowing how to manage things. And I think we've done much better in the last few weeks at turning that round, turning that conversation around and showing that we can grip this in the right way. I think we have to think really clearly about what we are post-Brexit, what kind of country we're going to be. I'd like to see us talk much more about liberty in the world, freedom in the world, the freedom to trade, liberty of security, talk much more about rights globally. Those sorts of issues around fundamental freedoms, I think something we can own in that post-Brexit context, and particularly at a moment when America is in retreat from those positions.
And I want to ask you quickly about Russia. I mean, are they way ahead of us in terms of the use of digital technology, and what influence is that having on the world's diplomacy?
I suppose it depends what you think of as being way ahead. Without doubt, they have mastered some of the dark arts of the internet. I got used to when I tweeted about Syria, for example, about Assad getting hit by a lot of Russian bots, you know, quite aggressive, nasty social media tactics. And it's clear, you know, that they have been interfering in successive elections in the West as well. So,
in Brexit, do you believe?
Well, I mean, the evidence is growing. But, I mean, I think not in such a fundamental way as they were clearly doing in America. And I think much more of their focus was on America. One of the things that worries me is the way that they seem to have been fanning extremism in the West, extremist reactions to terrorist attacks, for example. I mean, which, yeah, it's hard to understand the motivation of a country to behave in that way. So on one level, they are winning. My experience on Syria, you know, we were playing Putin with we're playing poker with Putin in 2013 over the future of Syria. But our challenge was that he could see our cards, you know, because we had this transparent, open debate about our policy, and he simply didn't. I think we win in the end because the internet is going to open up societies, and it's going to give people a much clearer idea of what's going on elsewhere, and that the autocracies and the Putins of this world will be in retreat ultimately.
And finally, we're talking about world diplomacy. Is the Foreign Office equipped for this digital age? And if not, what more should it be doing?
It's getting there. It's getting there. I mean, it's like any organization that is, you know, it's hundreds of years old. It's harder to innovate. It's harder to move forward fast. And diplomacy itself is under attack, you know, because, you know, there's less resource for it. There are many more people thinking that they can do diplomacy better. And because diplomacy has been failing on issues like Syria. But the FCO has some real strengths. I mean, it's small, it's low budget. It's got an amazing group of people who are very focused, working very hard in the national interest. It's got a great network in an age when networks really count for much more. And it's got a strong national brand, again, providing we manage Brexit in a rational, sensible way. I think it's modernized its consular crisis service very, very well. You know, in just a decade, that's completely transformed the way that we look after Brits abroad. But, you know, I think there's a recognition, and I did a review of the Foreign Office last year. It's still too male and pale. The network is a bit too stretched. It's lost a bit of mojo since Iraq. Probably Brexit as well has contributed to that. Not enough diplomats are actually overseas. And there's still a bit too much bureaucracy and kind of churn holding back diplomats from doing what they should be doing, which is really purposeful diplomacy to make Britain stronger and more prosperous and to spread our values. So it's heading in the right direction. There's a really good reform program. The IT is being sorted out. But it's evolving, and it will take time and patience and effort.
Tom Fletcher, thank you very much. And Tom's book, The Naked Diplomat, Understanding Power and Politics in the Digital Age, is out now in paperback. Finally this year, as Christmas approaches, spare a thought for the millions of people in Britain who will be spending it on their own. The Office for National Statistics has described this country as the loneliness capital of Europe. And the Joe Cox Commission on Loneliness found that almost three quarters of older people in the UK are lonely. It's a topic we've touched on in the past, but this week I returned to meet two MPs working cross-party to continue the work of the late Joe Cox.
So a year ago, I came to the office of Labour MP Rachel Reeves, who had teamed up with the Conservative MP Seema Kennedy to carry out the Joe Cox Loneliness Commission. Initially, it was a project that Seema, you were going to work on with Joe, and after Joe's untimely death, Rachel, you took over. And I'm here a year later to really just find out what it is that they learnt from that. Seema, what was the most shocking thing for you during this year?
I think what was most shocking for me were the statistics that came out about people with disabilities. 50% of them say that they feel lonely every day. And even more shocking was that the vast majority of able-bodied people say they don't think they have anything in common with disabled people. They wouldn't know how to speak to them. And that was really sad. And it shows that because people can have disabilities at all ages, there's millions of our fellow citizens that feel lonely and that people don't feel like they have a connection with.
And over the year, you've looked at loads of different groups. So disabled people were one of them. Are there other groups, Rachel, that you were quite surprised to learn about the levels of loneliness?
I think refugees and asylum seekers, we did a focus on how loneliness affects them. And I went to a conference in Leeds where many people spoke about their own personal experience, about living on the outskirts of a town, not knowing anybody that speaks the same language as you, not having the money to be able to get to groups and organisations that would be able to support you.
Okay, and just tell me what the impact is of loneliness in the economy. I mean, is there a financial impact?
Yes, there is a financial impact. There was some research that we did early in the year that businesses are saying it's about £3 billion a year because of, mainly among carers, because they have to take extra time off work for the people they're caring for whose problems are exacerbated by loneliness. But if you look at the cost to the exchequer in terms of what it's costing the NHS, that's massive as well. The chief nursing officer said last week that it's loneliness is a big cause of early mortality. In the report, what we've highlighted is that probably between about 5 and 10 patients who come to a GP every day are presenting because of loneliness. And there's the statistic that it's as bad as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So, you know, we've always said this is a moral issue, it's a health issue, it's an economic issue.
Can I just ask you about Joe? So, Seema, did Joe initially contact you about setting this up?
Yeah, that was about 2 years ago. You'll know, Anoushka, that at the end of term, there's a thing called the... you have a debate where you can talk about anything. This was 2 years ago, and almost to the day I spoke about various issues, one of which was loneliness. So Jo was obviously looking around for a Conservative to set up her commission with, and that's when she approached me. It's incredible, actually, to think that it's now almost 2 years on. And it was really powerful being there on Friday with her sister and her parents, who are just so inspiring with their strength and their commitment to carrying forward the things she believed in.
And why do you think Jo was searching out a Tory, Rachel?
Well, Jo was always keen, a Lancastrian Tory. Jo was always really keen to do things cross-party because she wanted to show, as she said in her maiden speech, we have more in common than that which divides us. And that wasn't just a good line in a speech. That was how Jo lived her life, both in politics and outside. And she tried to bridge gaps and work with people from across the political spectrum, as she did with Andrew Mitchell and Tom Tugendhat on other issues. And that's something that I found really inspiring, and something that when I've tried to carry on Jo's work, which I wanted to do because she was a good friend of mine, it's the work itself, and this is on the issue of loneliness, but also perhaps trying to do things a little bit more like Jo did politically, working cross-party, and that's been really inspiring for me, and it's been a real pleasure working with Seema.
So what do you think when some colleagues perhaps suggest that they wouldn't be mates with a Tory?
Well, I think, you know, give it a try. It might be better than you thought. I've learned a lot working from Seema. We don't always vote in the same division lobby at the end of the evening, but that doesn't mean that we don't have a huge amount in common, and it doesn't mean that by working together we can't make a difference. And I think working cross-party, you're actually more likely to secure the lasting change, which I think that all of us go into politics to try to do.
And let's just finish with some solutions. So you've spent a year doing this commission. What do you think needs to happen to try to help this epidemic, as you've called it, Rachel?
Yes, I've said that it goes beyond personal misfortune and now it's a social epidemic. But the great thing about this problem is that it is entirely solvable. We said at the beginning of the year to start a conversation. Start a conversation if you're a lonely person, start a conversation. If you know somebody in your street, in your neighbourhood, in your friendship group, in your family that's experiencing loneliness. And I think we've got a great opportunity over Christmas. The Jo Cox Foundation is running the Great Christmas Get Together, encouraging people to reach out within their communities and make time for people. One of the things that Jo was really great at was putting other people first. And if we all lived our lives a little bit more like Jo Cox lived hers, the world would probably be a slightly less lonely place.
And Seema, what would your key solution be?
So I think the key, we've made quite a few recommendations in the report, but I think the key solution for me is a measurement of loneliness across the life course and measurement of what the interventions and schemes are which are really effective. Because for me, there were two things when Jo died and I wanted to take on this work. There was one that the commission had to focus on all the ages, because that was something she felt very strongly about, and that whatever we came up with had to be very practical. Because she said to me, and I know I've repeated this a million times, she didn't want a report that just sat on a shelf and nothing was done. So I think the asks we've made of government are realistic, they're practical, and they're achievable.
That was Rachel Reeves and Seema Kennedy. And you can follow the links from our podcast page to find out more about their work on loneliness. But that's all for this year. My thanks to Michael Savage, Sam Lowe, Ellie Mae O'Hagan, Tom Fletcher, Rachel Reeves and Seema Kennedy. To them and to all our listeners, a very Merry Christmas. We'll be back in January. Until then, that's all from me, Anushka Astana and the Guardian Politics team. The producer was Phil Maynard. Thanks for listening.